Do you know what runs? I don't know if this is still the case, but for a long time, what was running LG's smart TV? What operating system they were using?
Oh no.
Ooh, okay. So Samsung put Tizen on their smart TVs. I don't know if they're still using that now. Consider all of this information like 12 years out of date.
Sure.
I stopped caring about this shit the minute I didn't have to really anymore. So at the time, Samsung was putting Tizen on, which is their in-house operating system that they used for their watches and some of their other wearable products. So it's kind of like their embedded OS. Okay. LG also needed an embedded OS, but like they didn't have one going. So they brought back a product that they bought on the cheap a long time ago, or that they bought from HP, which was WebOS, which is what ran on the touchpad.
Yeah, great.
Which was originally Palm OS.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, that goes
so
back.
I'm not positive, but I am positive that there are almost certainly pieces of Palm free, like Palm as Palm code running on LG smart TVs, I would assume.
You telling me that I can turn my LG smart TV into the Palm Trio?
You very well probably could make that happen. Anyway, welcome to Codex. I think this might actually be an intro because it's a little indicative of what I'm going to turn this into, and you're here for it as well, so I'm sorry. I'm Logan. I have my co-host Phil with me today, as always.
Hello.
So this is going to be a little different. So normally we talk about like some lore stuff, either in a game or a movie or something like that, some piece of media. But I consume a lot of nonfiction, primarily nonfiction. And a pretty scattered shot, I would say, a pretty eclectic mix of stuff. And I have to tell people about it. Yeah. It's, and most of it's, sad, and we're not going to talk about really any of that. I promised you that quite a while ago that I wouldn't like.
That was in the mission statement of the project. No bummers.
Yeah. It's just like, well, we've got Dan Carlin doing that. We don't need me to. He's got a better voice for it anyway. So
yes,
other people are doing that. But occasionally, those types of shows, I will run into some tidbit that is just neat. And I have to tell people about it. So we are going to call this segment Info Dumping. This will be semi-recurring, hopefully. Have you encountered that term before I mentioned it for this or no?
It feels like something that I have heard in just like the amalgam of being a person who works in knowledge work, but I can't place it as a thing that I have like run into that often.
Cool. So I did no research on this at all. But the first time I came across it was in like neurodivergent spaces online.
Okay.
Like ADHD, autism, those kinds of things. Groups of people predisposed to consuming large amounts of kind of scattershot information. And then you just gotta tell somebody about it. And usually it's just like someone just giving you all of the 40K lore when you ask a very surface level question. Like, this is what happens when you ask the wrong person the wrong question. They're like, actually, I have been waiting 20 years for me to relay the precise differences between wet and dry harvesting of cranberry bogs, which maybe we'll cover that one day. I don't know. But not today. Today, this is going to be something different. And as it's kind of our first one, we're going to sort of transition out of our regular format and into this by talking about some game stuff to start with, and then bringing that into a really weird thing that happened in the real world that I still can't believe no one told me about. So, how much you know about money?
Like besides it being a construct,
Yeah, that's what we're going with. I think that's probably going to be a trend with these episodes, is we are going to be talking about like weird social constructs a lot, either directly or indirectly, because those things fascinate me for probably obvious reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not really sure how much background to do here. Money's not real. We'll start with that. Like, a dollar is a dollar because we've all decided it's a dollar. And that's because it's super useful. And sometimes you have things that I want, but I don't really have anything you want. And that's what dollars are for. Or maybe I have something you do want, but I don't have it now. So most games and most people interact with money regularly. But what do you do when you don't have money? Or when you don't care about money, or if you don't care about that person's money specifically?
Like trading, is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, yeah. We're gonna talk about bartering today.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So you and I have kind of been dancing around this episode for a while as we've been starting this whole thing up. So you know a little bit about what we're gonna cover today, mostly the game things. You don't know the real world thing.
Correct,
but yeah. I want to start with Metro 2033, which is a game and a book and it's a whole thing that we will probably, man, I'm going to play it again. So yeah, we're going to cover Metro more because it seems like good fodder for this show.
Yeah.
Have you played through any of Metro? I know we talked about it a bit. I feel like you said no.
Yeah. So I have played through some of one of them, and it might have been 2033 or it might have been Last Light. And I think the only thing we ever really talked about is I remember there being like you go through your metro tunnels. Your main character's name is RTM. And at least in the one that I played, there is a really big reliance on the bullets for your gun is also the currency that you trade with other humans in the metro tunnels. But I honestly can't remember much more than that.
Perfect. That is about all we need. So for those not in the know, Metro 2033 is a post-apocalypse. The first game is set in Moscow Metro. So humanity has retreated to the underground tunnels of the metro system because the surface has been irradiated and is filled with monster beasties. It is a first-person shooter. It is also kind of a horror game, I feel like.
Yeah, it's that sounds right.
Yeah, it's the first one that I like let myself be scared while playing. I have a hard time like getting myself to play a horror game and like letting the experience happen. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Yeah, I get that. I feel like I mostly just dissociate in horror games.
Yeah, and that kind of like kills what I think is supposed to be the intended fun out of it.
Yeah.
So Metro was the first one where I was like, okay, this is a game I only play at night in the dark with headphones on, cranked up. And I'm just going to try to, like, fully immerse myself in this game. And it is, yeah, we'll come back to it, because it succeeds at that very well. But I don't want to spend too much time talking about the setting of that today. But what we are going to talk about is the bartering. So, yeah, as you stated, the primary currency is actually military-grade rounds, referred to as MGRs in the game. Obviously, bullets are super useful in this post-apocalyptic setting. They do more damage, the MGRs do, than like the dirty bullets that you find or can produce yourself. They're used as a currency both because of that utility and because there's no infrastructure to make more of them.
Okay.
So like
that makes sense.
They're very difficult to counterfeit because you just don't have, you know, a full-on factory and like clean supply chains in the post-apocalypse. So with bartering, let's see, I pulled up the wiki here. It looks like they average like a 5-to-1 or a 10-to-1 value compared to the clean rounds. So in the game, this means you have to make like choices between using your high damage rounds on their own or selling them for either like medical supplies or other ammunition. And it creates this really interesting tension where you don't want to be shooting your money, but sometimes you have to be shooting your money.
It's funny. I feel like there are, I was trying to think, I just ran into a game recently that had that, I'm not going to remember what it was, but you could basically put on a special suit of armor and instead of shooting bullets, it would shoot all of the money that you have. But I feel like it's always a gimmick when it's in other games. And I remember specifically in Metro, it was very much like, no, this is like a core tenet of the game. Like, this isn't like a fun different thing you can try out. Like, this is part of the atmosphere and the world that we are building here.
Yeah, I don't know if you are familiar with the term bullet economy, but it gives it like a real double meaning.
Yeah.
Okay. We will cut to the second reason that I've encountered bartering in games is old school RuneScape, which, man, I don't know how many episodes we're going to end up talking about RuneScape in. It's going to be a lot. Maybe we'll make like a whole RuneScape primer, because trying to explain RuneScape in passing is impossible.
It feels like one of those things that it's going to be, we just have to try to see how long it goes. Like, maybe there's like a ticker on each episode that's just like time to RuneScape and see how long it takes. See if the average goes up or down.
Yeah, just let me... I almost think you just give me like 2 minutes per episode to just kind of spin my wheels and burn myself out, and people can hit skip four times.
This is the RuneScape section.
Yeah. So we're not going to talk like too deeply about it. RuneScape is MMO fantasy RPG. There's your standard gold pieces are available in the game. So it has a full-fledged currency that is functional, and we will spend maybe multiple episodes talking about the economics of RuneScape, because it's Eve levels of weirdness. For today's purposes, we're just going to kind of touch on another reason bartering can persist, and that's when you're doing things like outside of the limitations of the currency system. So Old school RuneScape runs on 32-bit signed integers. Does that mean anything to you?
No, it does not. Cool.
So in binary, a 32-bit signed integer can go anywhere from, we're going to round because it doesn't matter, negative 2.1 billion to positive 2.1 billion.
Okay.
So any value can be in between those two numbers inclusively.
Okay.
If you try to go past that, the game freaks out and it doesn't understand it. And that causes all kinds of weird issues in all kinds of systems. Like any computer thing anywhere has to deal with integer overflow problems.
Okay.
But in this case, in old school RuneScape's Grand Exchange, their like kind of auction system, that means you can't sell an item for more than 2.1 billion gold because it doesn't go any higher. That's as big as the button goes. You can't make a number bigger than that, because the computer literally cannot fathom a number one bigger than that.
Okay.
It doesn't exist. So sometimes you have to trade items manually when they're worth more than that. And there's like a whole black market system for how much an item is worth when you can't value it in like the standard gold methods.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So there are items in this game that are worth a certain amount of gold that is larger than the amount of money that you can trade within the game. Like somehow. Yes. Okay. So somehow the economics of the game have just like run away, or is that like, is that
so? It has a fully functioning economy to a large degree. So the prices for items in RuneScape, if they're sold in a shop by an NPC, then that is going to be set by the The devs. Wow. My brain turned off for a second there. Completely blacked out. That's going to be set by the developers. There's another limiting factor, which is the high alchemy value. And that is a spell you can cast, which just turns an item into gold pieces.
Okay.
So that provides a floor. So you're typically not going to see an item drop below its high alc value plus the cost to cast that spell. Because at that point, you can just turn it into gold. Yeah. So if we have a shield, a rune square shield or something, we'll just give it a high alc value of 10,000 gold pieces. You're not going to find someone selling them for 8,000 gold pieces because they would just turn it into 10,000 themselves. It takes a second and it costs like 200 gold to cast that spell. Okay. So that kind of provides a floor, but there's not really a ceiling.
Okay.
So if you have an item that is incredibly useful, and or typically both incredibly rare, then the price is whatever someone's willing to pay for it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So the grand exchange is specifically like a player to player marketplace.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So you put in, I take my item, I shove it in a box, and I say, I'm going to set a price of 105,000 gold pieces on it. Mm-hmm. And if you, as a different person, have a buy offer in for that amount or for more, then that trade happens automatically through the back end of the system.
Okay.
And I get your gold, and you get my item, and now there's a tax, and a little bit gets cut off the top, and maybe we'll go through inflation and RuneScape someday and try to explain all of that. But if I'm trying to sell you something that the community, we as a group, have decided is worth 3 billion gold pieces.
Yeah, you're SOL. You got to have another method.
I can't do it in the exchange. Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But that also means like the trackers and all of the systems that monitor the trades on the exchange can't tell either.
Oh, it's also, so is it also just a black box? Like it is
kind of.
Okay. So
now it's in Discord.
It truly is black market trading then.
Yes. Yes. It is 1,000% black market trading. And we'll get into like how I made all my money flipping items on the exchange and how like trading off of the exchange to not be picked up. But yeah, we'll get into, that'll be a whole other episode. Because I could, info nothing. I could talk to you for like 3 hours about that. I have talked to you for hours about that.
Yes, you have. I feel like I need to go read the Leviathan before we talk about that. Yes.
So we'll the pin in that for another episode will be we'll talk about a time where somebody accidentally sold one of the most valuable items in the game for, I think it was 1 or 2 gold pieces. Maybe it was 5. Oh. And it happened through the exchange. They put a $2 billion gold piece item into the exchange, expecting to get 2 billion from it, and they got like less than 1,000.
Whoops.
So yeah, we'll talk about that a different day.
Okay.
That was just mostly to kind of land the concept of bartering in some systems that we've interacted with before. And now we're going to talk about the real world thing that I have teased to you for like weeks now on and off as I've been trying to figure out how to present this. Phil, do you know about the time that the Pepsi Corporation became the 6th largest navy on the planet?
No. I thought this was going to be about trading paperclips for Harrier jets. I didn't realize we were talking about Pepsi.
We are talking about Pepsi today. We are talking about Pepsi and the Soviet Union.
All right. Okay. I am ready for this. Let's go.
Okay. So this, I wish I had like a ton of deep information to give you here. This is going to be relatively surface level. I first heard about this on the podcast Lions Led by Donkeys, which I would recommend anyone check out if they are not familiar with it. Joe, the host there, covers a lot more backstory and a lot more backstory on kind of like the economics relations between the Soviet Union and the United States than we'll probably touch on here, because that seems like a whole can of worms that if I start going down that path, I would have had to read like 9 books and then this episode never would have happened. So we're going to be pretty surface level. But that was episode 62. Check the show notes. We'll put a link to their episode in there. Give it a listen. So this was as relations were starting to warm up between the United States and the Soviet Union. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, we're seeing like all of these companies trying to get inroads into the USSR, because it's a huge chunk of land and people, that are not like really economically interacting with the United States directly in any way.
Yeah.
So Pepsi wins this bid. They get an exclusive contract to distribute within the USSR. And there's this whole, again, listen to the Lions Led by Donkeys episode. There's a whole kind of backstory about how that happened. But if you're Pepsi and you are trying to make a deal with the Soviet government, what do you want in exchange for Pepsi?
Yeah. They're probably not readily taking US dollars, huh?
Well, and what are they going to give you? Like,
yeah.
What are you going to do with Soviet currency as the Pepsi Corporation? You can't. No one else cares. They have a command economy. Like, their currency has a value of zero outside of the Soviet Union.
Sure.
Like, Pepsi can't take Soviet bucks and pay people in the United States with them or really buy anything outside of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So what they initially do is they say, hey, how about, since we're like a, you know, we're a beverage distributor, we kind of know that business. We'll give you Pepsi and you give us Stolichnaya Vodka.
Okay.
So the initial deal was, I think it was a 1-for-1. It might've been a 1-for-1 in volume. I'm not positive on that. The initial deal was Pepsi was the sole distributor of Stolichnaya Vodka in the United States. And the inverse is true in the Soviet Union. So they were able to set up some bottling plants and everything they needed to bottle Pepsi and distribute it through the Soviet Union.
Okay.
So now we have like the first U.S. consumer products breaking the barrier into the Soviet Union. And now we're also seeing Soviet products, Russian vodka, coming in and being purchasable on U.S. store shelves for the first time.
Okay.
So this is a pretty good deal for everybody. This is working out well. Everyone is we'll say making money, but everyone's happy with this deal.
Yeah.
But eventually, turns out like there are more Russians willing to drink a lot of Pepsi than there are U.S. citizens able to down equal equivalents of Stolichnaya Vodka.
Yeah.
And eventually, there's only so much Stoli that Pepsi can take before it's no longer useful.
Yeah, they're getting hyperinflated on vodka.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, spring of 1989, Pepsi's like, hey, we would like to give you significantly more Pepsi, because at this point they're already drinking like a billion servings of Pepsi a year. Like it gets big quick.
Okay.
And they're like, hey, we can't have this much vodka. So what else do you have?
Oh, wait. Okay. So before we dig into that, so it's both. So if it's a 1-for-1, right? Like Pepsi can only make so much more Pepsi to provide the USSR before they have to increase the amount that they're sending to us as well. So like there's an upper limit on the amount of Pepsi that can be given or like made before the deal is broken. Is that what you're saying?
Kind of, yeah. Because at some point, the vodka will be worth less to Pepsi than the Pepsi is.
Yeah.
Like you said, you're going to they're going to have a problem where eventually that vodka is just not worth too much anyway. They can only move so much of it. Yeah, and if no one's buying it, then it's not different than giving away Pepsi for free and
right.
having to fill a warehouse with nothing.
Huh. Okay.
So in order for the USSR to convince Pepsi to give them more Pepsi, they yeah. had to give them something more than just vodka, because the vodka was no longer paying for it.
Okay. And is it, I know so little about how the Soviet Union actually worked, especially in the late 80s, but when you're talking about basically the Pepsi being given to the USSR, like are those plants, are they nationalized? Like the Pepsi product that is being distributed to the people of Russia, like is that like a state asset?
I know it was bottled locally. Probably. I think they were, I'm not positive, but okay. I believe they were just shipping them the syrup.
Okay. Okay.
Like a restaurant or a movie theater where they get those big okay. like bags of syrup, and then you mix it with the soda water to create okay. pop. Gotcha. So they're shipping them the syrup, and then the bottling is happening locally. And I believe that's roughly how it's done in the U.S. still as well, isn't it?
That's right.
The bottling happens on a regional basis. Because you're just shipping less by weight then.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
you're doing the concentrated syrup compared to the finished product.
That makes sense. Okay.
So, yeah.
So they have too much.
Yeah. Soviet Union says, hey, we need more Pepsi. And Pepsi says, cool, we will sell you more Pepsi, but we don't care about your currency. And we have vodka out of our ears at this point. So why would we give you more Pepsi? What do you got? And the Soviet Union is like, how about 17 diesel submarines, a frigate, a cruiser, and a destroyer? Does that do anything for you?
Okay.
And Pepsi was like, you know what? That sounds all right. That sounds pretty good. So yeah, we're not far from the Berlin Wall coming down at this point.
Sure.
Like, things are not going well at the Soviet end. And these were like decommissioned, like I said, they were diesel subs. And at this point, I mean, you're talking late 80s. So like any
yeah.
submarine in any of these large navies that's worth anything is going to be nuclear at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, 17 submarines, a frigate, a cruiser, and a destroyer. They also later had a deal with, like some tankers and a few other things.
Okay. So yeah. they just took Pepsi out back and said, look at this boneyard. What would you like?
Which of our decommissioned warships, is worth a lot of your sweet syrup?
Huh. Wow. Okay.
So, Pepsi inks this deal. They got transferred to Norway or one of the
Baltic.
Baltic Nordic countries, somewhere in there. And okay. then they were just scrapped and parted out and sold for scrap metal, essentially. But for a very brief period of time, Pepsi was the sixth largest naval force wow. on the planet by ship count.
Okay, but so this was not what I had expected at all. But the idea of those dumb mid-2000s like Craigslist reality shows where they give someone a paperclip and say, "I would like you to barter your way to the yeah. top of whatever you can get." It is very funny to think about. Hello, I have a 30 rack of Pepsi. Would you like to trade me your 95 Honda Civic for it? Yeah. And that's basically what happened.
That's entirely what happens. Yeah. Except it's wow. a billion 30 packs of Pepsi. Yeah. And yeah.
Wow. Okay. So all of those, and are we sure that all of those ships were decommissioned? Like
here's the thing, I couldn't find a lot. I was hoping to like really track those vessels and figure out kind of exactly what happened to them. And I was not able to do so. Although I did not try like exceedingly hard. I tried a little bit for a little while.
Yeah.
I don't know. This feels, yeah, right? the CEO of Pepsi at the time was apparently ran into Bush's security advisor, Bush one, at the time, because he was president at the time, and gave him the line that we're disarming the Soviet Union faster than you are. Because
it's pretty good.
That's decommissioning a bunch of their ships. Yeah. Yeah. Like, all right. I'll give you tip of the cap to that one. Probably a war criminal too, but tip of the cap to that one.
I mean, also he's untouchable now because he's just driving around in his diesel submarines.
Right. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like I found out about that. I was like, how did I make it this far? This just feels like something I would have run into by now in either, like, I don't know, one of those dumb trivia books that you got at a Scholastic book fair in the fourth grade, or I don't know. I feel like there's at least like two alternate history novels here that are very silly to write.
Yeah. Like it's wow. Yeah. I mean, that's just, alternate history novels. Like, imagine just this entire time we're talking about the Soviet Union and everything. All I'm thinking about is Hunt for Red October. But what if it was Hunt for Red October, except it was a handover of the Pepsi subs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
And
really
Coke starts dropping death charges. And like,
really, really changes the tenor of that movie if Sean Connery's hat is actually just a jaunty Pepsi cap.
Yeah. You just like merge that with Rollerball and it becomes this weird corpo futuristic hellscape. Yeah.
Wow. Huh. It's very weird. The other topic that you have dangled in front of my face that I'm very curious about is the whole Pepsi Harrier jet thing. And it really feels like Pepsi for a while there was like, well, fuck it. We can't be Coca-Cola in the United States. So what if we became our own nation?
We've got an air force. The Cola Wars. And
yeah. They're like, all right, let's arm up, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Uh-huh. So I don't know. It's just a delightful little history tidbit that I have to tell people about.
Yeah, that's incredible. I also cannot believe that I didn't know that this was a thing.
Right? I was so afraid. I was like, how do I ask Phil about this enough that he knows what I'm getting at, but not enough that I tip my hand in case he has no idea?
Yeah, I have never heard of this. This is incredible.
Yep.
I am going to be spending the rest of the afternoon doing some Googles to see what I can find.
I know. This has been just bouncing around my noggin for like a few months now.
That's incredible. Good job keeping a good secret.
So there is our first episode of Info Dumping. I don't know if they'll tie into game stuff every time. We'll do the Pepsi Harrier jet thing we'll probably cover at some point. That's going to be like us sitting down and talking about contract law, which is only interesting to me and like four other people, and I'll probably do a bad job of it, so who knows if that'll happen, but
perfect.
I think it's neat.
I'll just be over here really excited about Harrier jets.
Yeah we could just talk about Harrier jets for a while and then like watch True Lies maybe, because that's a great
that's what I thought of immediately.
Maybe we just we could. I'm going to watch Red October now, probably this upcoming week, because it's a perfect film. Yeah. So we'll do the Harrier jet. I think the third wave is going to be next. That one's going to be a little darker. That one's going to be right on the edge, I think, of how dark can we go with info dumping before before I'm not allowed to talk about it. Again, that's the California high school experiment in fascism.
Oh yes. Yes. Yes.
It doesn't get more violent than like a bar fight.
Okay, well that's already more violent than I thought it got. But
there
I guess there are no direct
deaths that I can trace specifically to the experiment.
Okay,
how about
that? Well, you know, that's something.
I feel mostly comfortable saying that.
Okay, we'll work with that.
But yeah, so until then. I'm Logan.
Yeah, and I'm Phil.
And this has been Info Dumping.
Yeah, if you like the show or the idea, or you've got something that's kind of like clawing at the back of your brain that is very similar to, man, how did I make it my entire life without knowing Pepsi had a naval force? Go over to the website, gordonhamburger.com, and there's the contact tab for show ideas and stuff. Just shoot us a message. Otherwise, yeah, like, subscribe, rate, review, you know, all the internet things. And we will see you next week.
Not very long ago, America introduced Pepsi to the Soviet Union. And while it may be just a coincidence, a lot of refreshing changes have taken place ever since. Pepsi, a generation ahead.
Give me a ping, Vasily. One ping only, please.